To introduce to you Dr. Ron Epstein, a professor of family medicine, psychiatry, and oncology at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and who's board certified in family medicine and hospice and palliative medicine. He also serves as the director of the Rochester Center to Improve Communication in Healthcare and is the director of the Dean's Teaching Fellowship Program. That sounds a little bit like our Teaching Scholars program. In addition to what you will see in his bio and on our flyer for today, he is a dedicated family physician, practitioner, and medical educator. And I can tell you that much of his work in assessment and in mindful practice has influenced our work here at McGill. Yesterday afternoon, some of us had the pleasure and privilege of being involved in a workshop with Dr. Epstein on mindful practice. Some heard his presentation this morning on the assessment of professional competence, and I can assure you that we're in for a treat this afternoon as we further explore mindful practice. With that, Ron, it's a pleasure. And as we say in Quebec, bienvenue.
Merci beaucoup. I'm really pleased to be here, and it's been a great. It's actually just been about 24 hours, but it's been quite a whirlwind, and it's. I've really enjoyed meeting people, and also the interactivity with which that you bring to everything. I really like it. So, what I'd like to do is give you a bit of an overview of what mindful practice is and some thoughts about how it might be cultivated with a look at practitioners at all levels, not just medical school, but also residents and practicing physicians. I would like to start with a poem, and because this is one that I think has... influenced me quite a bit in my thinking about kind of the work that I'll be talking about in a minute. It was written quite a while ago by a guy named Rumi, who was a 13th century Persian poet. Some of you may have heard it because the poem itself has made the rounds. But so I'll read it and then hopefully make some connections between the kinds of insights that he had and the work that I would like to share with you. So the poem is called The Guest House, and it goes like this. This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. And I'll leave you to decide what the beyond is for you. So for me, that's a pretty accurate description of my work as a family physician. There are visitors who come in, their concerns, their deportment, the way that they interact with me as another human being is rather unpredictable and often distressing. And what I'm going to be talking about is how we approach these often distressing and sometimes uninvited situations in medicine. So thinking about who these visitors are to our guest house who might violently sweep our house empty of its furniture, there are a few things that seem to come up. One is ambiguity and uncertainty, both of presentation as well as what we should do about patients' concerns, conflict, strong emotions, the patient's and yours, the issue of blame, who's at fault for either an error or a situation that may even be beyond someone's control, unanticipated serious events, and then also other things that are pretty sobering, like the impermanence of knowledge, intractable problems, and the illusion of control, especially when it's shattered. When thinking about when things go wrong in medical practice, when there are errors or bad outcomes, the literature really points to four potential areas. There are patient factors, that is, if patients don't tell us what's wrong, or if they're unable to understand, or if they're dishonest, or if their families somehow prevent them from sharing their concerns with us. There are microsystem factors, that healthcare systems and teams don't function the way they should. Handoffs between different teams involve poor communication. There are distractions. There are larger systems factors, such as physician incentives to do certain things and not others. In the U.S., access to care is a huge issue. Mass media, the influence of industry on our practice patterns. And then something that's really not been looked at very much until recently are clinician factors. And when thinking about clinician contributions to errors, lack of knowledge and skill is really rarely the cause. That is, often people know what to do and recognize their errors in retrospect. It's just the application and lack of noticing the appropriate times to apply those skills and that knowledge that they have. So inadequate data acquisition, misinterpretation of findings, premature closure, situational cognitive impairment due to cognitive overload or other factors, ineffective communication. This list is familiar to everyone. But what's interesting is where that list comes from. That is, why we don't gather adequate data, why we engage in premature closure. And some of that has to do with perceptual distortion, that is, either not seeing things that are there, or seeing things that aren't there, that is, imagining things, because our expectations sometimes are very strong. I'll give you examples of all of these as we go along. Stereotyping, the whole phenomenon of implicit bias, that is, bias of which you're completely unaware, does condition clinical behavior. And we know that, for example, obese people will generate different clinical decisions than people who are skinny. Black people will generate different clinical decisions than white people, all not at the least having to do with their clinical situation, but rather with the stereotypes that we unconsciously apply to them. Unexamined emotions, if you're annoyed, tired, fed up, angry, but also if you like a patient a lot, that can affect how you communicate with people and what kinds of diagnostic workups you might do. I have been in the same practice for 25 years, and sometimes I can't tolerate the thought that a patient that I know and love might have a fatal illness. It's very difficult. It represents a threat, the potential loss of a friend. Over-concreteness, mistaking the map for the territory, and also a lack of self-monitoring. And during the talk, I'll go into greater detail about each of these issues. So let's consider a situation. There's this, when I was a resident, I was working in the pediatric emergency room. And a child came in at about 4 or 5 in the morning who had a fever. It was a young child, and there's always concern with kids with fevers that they might have meningitis. So I examined the child, including to see if the neck was supple or not. I realized, though, after the fact, that determination that the neck wasn't supple, or that the neck was supple, that it was not stiff, was conditioned by a whole bunch of other factors. That is, my perception of stiffness was conditioned by the fact that if I decided the neck was stiff, I would have to wake up my otherwise cranky resident to supervise me doing a lumbar puncture. I would cause worry in a parent that might be unnecessary worry. I would do something painful to a child. All in the service of trying to provide improved clinical care. But what I mean by immaculate perception is that this sense, this physical sensation of suppleness or stiffness was interpreted differently at 5 in the morning than it would have been interpreted at 5 in the afternoon. And I was totally unaware. It just felt supple. Whereas at 5 in the afternoon, it may have been stiff enough. Now, we do this all the time. And in fact, neurocognitive research seems to show that all perception involves descending pathways that basically open or close gates, if you want to think about it that way. We first understood that in terms of pain, the gate theory of pain. But in fact, vision and hearing and smell, and in fact, perception of our own thoughts involves descending pathways that are controlled based upon prior experience, affect, and sensation. Okay, so our own perceptual abilities are modified and modifiable. Apter came up with what he calls reversal theory. I won't describe this in great detail, but his idea is that there are really at least two factors that seem to influence whether we're working in this optimal work zone or not. So when I was seeing that kid at 5 in the morning, I was not in my optimal work zone. I was in a low hedonic state. It was unpleasant, okay? And also, I was anxious, okay? So I was not, but notice that boredom is equally dangerous, and relaxation is equally dangerous, and being overly excited. You know, the excited intern who wants to make the diagnosis and therefore ends up testing a patient to death. You know, I mean, there are all sorts of ways that these things can manifest. So thinking about arousal level and hedonic tone as being two factors, and trying to know whether you're in this optimal work zone, and if you're not, what to do about it, is really the core of what I call self-monitoring, which is the ongoing moment-to-moment habit of seeking and integrating and responding to internal and external data about one's own performance during everyday work. So here we are with this child in the emergency room. The internal data is what I'm feeling. I'm tired. I'm afraid of what the resident will say, afraid of humiliation, afraid the kid's going to die, whatever. That's the internal data that I'm getting, this twisting feeling in my stomach, whatever it is. And then there's external data. That is, this is a child who's looking somewhat pale, not modeled. I could get him to smile with some effort, but he was basically kind of irritable. The end of the story was a good one. The child did fine, did not have the lumbar puncture, but I always wonder. I always wonder. So these data are impersonal data that we use. So, you know, if you take a board exam and you find that your score on pediatric endocrinology is low, then you can incorporate some of that into, you know, the work that you do later or future learning plans. But what I'm more interested in here is interpersonal and intrapersonal data. That is, data that you get as a result of relating to people and data that you get as a result of relating to yourself, and how you use those data to accomplish the goal of self-monitoring. Now, this is really important because when I close the door to the room when I'm seeing a patient, nobody is looking. Okay, so the idea of professions as being self-regulating really fundamentally come down to the individual practitioner. I have to have some way of knowing if I'm competent right now or less than competent, or if I'm practicing at a level of expertise that I'd be proud of, or if there's something lacking. Okay, we're all in this position of having to observe ourselves and make judgments about, you know, whether even to call in a consultant or not. You know, will that be a good thing, or don't you need to do that? Doctors think in fundamentally two ways. One is Kahneman called them type 1 and type 2. That's really helpful. I'll stop here. But fundamentally, one of the ways is analytic thinking, that is, trying to amass a body of data and logically going through that data, deciding when you've got enough data, and then figuring out what the potential explanations or potential links between those data might be in an organized way. So if it has to do with diagnosis, for example, you'll say, oh, yes, this person has stomach pain in their belly. The pain's more on the right side than the left, and, in fact, it's a little bit higher than the middle of their belly. And, you know, when they had the pain, they felt kind of nauseous. And this has happened before, especially after they went out to ate a big plate of French fries. And this is beginning to make a pattern. And we accumulate this data and try to put it all together piece by piece to try to diagnose a case of biliary colic. The alternative, the non-analytic, is that you take one look at this patient clutching their right side, and the emesis basin next to them, and you say, okay, there's something going on here, and my impression is, you know, that this is biliary colic, but I'll try to look at other things. So it's this picture that we create. Now, in fact, they're not just static pictures. Psychologists have called these things scripts. That is, they're like little movies in a way that are activated. So if I say to you, I've been having this, those of you who are clinicians will begin to finish my sentence. I've got my fist next to the left side of my chest. You'll begin creating this little movie, and it'll say chest pain with some shortness of breath, and yes, I feel sweaty. And you're creating this whole movie, this whole scenario. This is very, very useful because it allows us to practice efficiently. But it also can get us in trouble if these scripts are activated inappropriately. Interestingly, pharmaceutical advertising is brilliantly created so as to activate scripts in situations where they otherwise might not be. They get you thinking about things that you otherwise might not, especially in boundary conditions. So even though we know that a mildly elevated cholesterol level in someone who has no other risks for heart disease does not confer any other risk for death other as compared to a normal cholesterol level, the script of cholesterol leading to heart disease is very easily activated through advertising, for example, advertising to us or advertising to patients. So it's in those boundary conditions that inappropriate activation of scripts tends to happen. So what do we know about how the brain processes sensory input, and how might this be useful for this process of self-monitoring? And there's been quite a bit of interesting work using functional MRI imaging to try to understand how decisions are made and the role of affect and sensation in decision-making. Damasio came up with what he called a somatic marker hypothesis of memory, which influences some of what I'm going to talk about, which is that when we learn something, we sometimes learn things as abstract propositional facts. But you all know that during your training, if you see a patient with a particular condition, you're going to remember more about that condition than if you read about it in a book. Now, why is that the case? Well, for several reasons. One is because you touch, see, smell, and listen to that patient. So there's sensory input, raw sensory input, that's packaged with the knowledge of that illness. So when you think about biliary colic, you're thinking about that person lying on their side in the emergency room with the emesis basin next to them. The second is that memory is packaged with affect, with emotion. So that not only are we remembering because of those sensory inputs, but also our feelings about the situation. That this is someone who maybe evokes some degree of sympathy or compassion or fear. If it's someone who's got searing chest pain going to their back that started suddenly and their blood pressure seems to be going down, for me that induces a mild sense of panic. I'm worried that they've got a dissecting aortic aneurysm or something very, very bad. Those emotions, again, are very useful. It tells you, it's the feeling that you have when you see someone who's depressed and you get this sinking feeling, or someone who a sick child, for example, before you even notice the modeling, there's something that you can see that you're aware of in that kind of pre-analytic mode. Now, what we know is that the medial prefrontal cortex is one area that controls those descending perceptual pathways. That is, that's an area of the brain that, in a way, opens or closes the gate to sensory input and to future data. In a way, it's what decides if you know enough to make a decision, but also it's the gate that closes when you've made a premature decision. Okay, it closes prematurely. Just thinking about this concretely, and also what we know is that it's an area that is rich in other connections to other parts of the thinking and decision making pathways. The lesson that I've learned from at least a bit of the work that I've read in cognitive neuroscience is that we can not only be aware of raw perception, but we can actually also, to some degree, control this filtering process. And I'll give you a couple of examples to make this more concrete. Before I do that, I'll just propose one other concept that might be thought of as the opposite of self-monitoring or the opposite of mindfulness, and that has been variably called mindlessness or denial or self-deception or delusion, and that's the tendency of the mind to close prematurely, that imposes a definition on things and then mistakes the definition for the actual experience. Let me just give you an example here. This is my friend Tim, and a few weeks after we were hiking in the Cascades, he was diagnosed with stage 2 transitional cell cancer of the bladder. Those of you who came to the talk yesterday heard this story, so I apologize. He had cystoscopic surgery, had a Foley catheter placed. The catheter was removed. He developed a clot and therefore urinary obstruction. The catheter was placed again, and then it was removed on a Thursday afternoon. By Friday afternoon, he noticed that he had scanty urination and lower abdominal pain. His urologist's office was closed. He went to the emergency room at a local hospital. The emergency room was busy, and at least by report, it was noted that he was having scanty urination, so someone started an IV. They presumably thinking that he was dehydrated. When he failed to urinate despite the IV, they increased the rate of the IV. Okay, so this is what I would call mindlessness or delusion or mistaking or premature closure. This, despite disconfirming evidence, you're doing treatment. The treatment isn't working. You just try harder. Okay, now. Unfortunately, this went on all night, despite complaints of pain from him and protests from his wife, until they actually called me, and I called the floor nurse with the authority of a physician, trying to sort out what was going on. The floor nurse told me that the patient spent a very comfortable night, which was a complete lie, and that the resident would be there very shortly. I said, well, how shortly? In any case, a little while later, when the resident came and put in a Foley catheter, recognizing what the error was, 2 liters of urine were drained. Let me just give you another example. When I was doing my surgery rotation in the third year of medical school, I was involved in a retroperitoneal lymph node dissection for an 18-year-old who was diagnosed with cancer. This was the day before MRI scans. A staging operation, and the surgeon had finished dissecting one of the kidneys and had gone to the other side of the table to dissect the other kidney. Now, he could see the kidney he was working on, but I, on the opposite side of the table, could see the kidney that he had just finished. Okay. And I noticed that the kidney was beginning to turn blue. Now, I didn't know very much as a medical student, but I generally knew that pink was good and blue was bad. And so I mentioned something to the surgeon. He basically said the equivalent of, shut up, kid, and completely ignored my comment. And I was the one who really had the best view of this. So then a few minutes later, I noticed the kidney was turning a dusky purple. I mentioned this to the nurse who was standing next to me, who mentioned it to the intern who was standing across from her, who mentioned it to the surgeon. I learned a lot about the sociology of medicine at that point. And the surgeon panicked. He actually looked and saw, in fact, that this kidney was dying. Now, this is an 18-year-old kid. You know, he kind of needs his kidneys for a little while. Tried to untorse the kidney on its pedicle, could not restore blood flow, called in a vascular surgeon who performed an emergency endarterectomy, ultimately restoring blood flow, but not before causing some damage to that kidney. When this, I was rounding with the surgeon the next day, or he mentioned to the patient and his mother that there was an unavoidable complication involving a vascular procedure. And that memory has really stuck with me for a long time, the word unavoidable. So just to give a little example of how we might or might not see things, what I'd like to do is a little exercise. And so I'd like you to watch this video. If you've seen this video before, please don't say anything. Okay. So this has made the rounds a little bit, and okay.
This is an awareness test. How many passes does the team in white make?
Go!
The answer is 13. But did you see the moonwalking bear?
No!
Okay. I think the point was made. It's really fascinating, these things. Let me just show you a couple other things here. Okay, so this is there are two images here. The two images differ on just one detail. I'll just play. They'll flash back and forth very rapidly. Okay, so who sees any difference between the two images? No? Nothing? Okay, let me try again. Okay, keep looking. I can make it bigger if you want. Okay, so look right behind the Sphinx's shoulder here. Okay, yeah, okay, right. So now try not to see it. Okay. Here we go. So I've got another one for you here. So, this is what I always thought would be fun, to be an experimental psychologist, if this is what they do with their time. So, okay, what's the difference between the two images here? Okay, so you see the horizon changes. Okay, but it takes a while to, there's some of these that actually I've watched over and over and over again and still can't find. And I won't allow myself to look at the key. But So here are a couple of more clinical examples. I've done a series of studies that involve training actors, standardized patients, to go into clinical practices unannounced, with hidden tape recorders to study various different kinds of clinical behavior. This is all with physicians' prior permission and IRB approved. This is not, but it still is a form of espionage. And it's a secret shopper. I mean, it's been used in industry for years. Okay, so here are these actors, and in this case, this is someone who has kind of nonspecific chest pain that's very hard to characterize. But they're all programmed about 5 to 7 minutes into the consultation to ask the physician, could this be something serious? So, again, this is kind of throwing a wrench into the works. It's increasing cognitive load, is what the psychologist will say, because it raises the specter of doubt and ambiguity physicians tend not to like, so it makes it more lower hedonic tone, okay, got that, and also higher anxiety, okay. And so what we tend to do with higher cognitive load is we try to simplify. Okay, we try to ignore details and try to come up with situations. And it's one thing in that really invites bias to emerge. So now we're actually doing studies on racial bias and pain prescribing. And so we're using standardized patients, and we're specifically increasing cognitive load to see if, in fact, that does bring out differences, and it seems to. So what I'd like you to look at is the clinical actions of these four clinicians. Now, these are reenactments. What we did was audio recorded the encounters, then asked the standardized patients to give us some notes about how the physician appeared, how they looked, and then we recreated them and filmed them with actors. So these are all actors. But I did not make any of these up. Okay, this is real stuff. It's absolute verbatim transcript. Okay, so here's the first one, and I'd like you to think about the whole issue of mindfulness and self-awareness. Okay, think about logical consistency. Think about whether this person's being patient-centered in some way.
Do you think it's something serious?
I would doubt that it's something serious.
Yeah.
Because you said, how long does it last? A couple minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you get heartburn?
I don't know. I don't think so.
This could be heartburn.
Mm.
Let me do an EKG on you.
Okay.
Okay. So, what did you notice? Let's start with logical consistency. Okay. What else did you notice? Right. Okay. So this is rather disorganized thinking. Okay. Fuzzy logic. What else? Okay. So premature closure, and then right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So. Right, right. And what we've found actually is that reassurance without providing a cogent explanation actually increases patient anxiety. Okay, any other observations? So just, that's mindlessness 101. Okay, here we go.
I hope it's not my heart. Do you think it's something serious?
Probably not. Again, if you had heart pain for 2 weeks, you'd probably be dead, okay?
Oh.
So, that's the good news. You're still alive. It must not be your heart.
Oh, so it must not be my heart.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Now, in all fairness, we all think these things, okay? You know, if you've got someone who's had chest pain for a week, I mean... You know, if it was an MI, they'd be dead. You know, I mean, but, you know, we're not much further along here. So, okay, this one is a peculiarly American example, but I'll play it anyway.
I was kind of worried it might be something serious going on.
What insurance do you have?
So, I'm sure you all are finding our health care reform debates very amusing. Now, clearly this would go through my mind also, because if I were considering doing diagnostic testing, this might be actually rather important. I wouldn't want this patient to end up with a bill for $3,000 worth of tests that they couldn't pay for, which is an unfortunate reality that we live with. Now, pay attention to this one. And while not perfect, I'd like you to just try to pay attention to some elements that might show the emergence of mindfulness.
Do you think this could be something serious?
I think it's going to be something around the intestinal tract. I don't think it's your heart, based on what you're telling me. I have to examine you and do a few preliminary tests to try to figure this out.
Okay.
Now, how many children do you have?
I have two children. I'm divorced. I have Joe and Maria.
And they live with you then?
Mm-hmm. They live with me.
Now, in a minute, I'm going to have you sit up there so I can examine you.
Okay.
But is there something you're concerned about and you're afraid of?
Well, I guess being 50 now, I just turned 50, it seems like every day I'm reading about something else with heart disease and cancer, you know. And
just all the bad things.
Here. Yeah, I guess. I don't know if it's age catching up to me. The years just seem to be...
Now, I think down here that you used to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what did you notice? Okay, so he's able to tolerate ambiguity and uncertainty. So he's not concerned about his own self. He's able to step outside of himself to be present to her. What else? Jumped around. Was that a good thing, a bad thing, or a neutral thing? Yeah, I'm not always quite so sure, because one thing that we've noticed is that sometimes when you have this sudden increase in cognitive load, you need time to regroup and really gather your thoughts. So asking her about her children may have been a time for him to actually recalibrate himself. So I used to be critical of those kinds of digressions, but now I'm not. Actually, I think it can be useful in terms of self-monitoring, as long as you return to the previous concern. If it's a digression that continues to go away from the concern, then it's problematic. So he was attentive. His level of reactivity was lower. He didn't feel like he had to solve the problem or make it go away or distract from the problem in some way. He maintained a level of curiosity about the patient's experience. He was able to see a situation from more than one perspective. And there's a great quote from William James that was also echoed by F. Scott Fitzgerald, which basically says that that people who are able to maintain two contradictory views of the same situation somehow have a greater mental capacity, that it's a sign of kind of mental suppleness or a great mind, as Fitzgerald put it. So there was that ability to say, yes, it's GI, but we need to make sure it's not something else, maintaining that ability to see a situation from more than one perspective. And also, he didn't stop from gathering data, even though the cognitive load was high. It didn't prevent him from... But I think what you saw was just, to some degree, a diminished reactivity. Now, mindful practice is a purposeful act, okay? Being mindful is not devoid of effort. That is, it's intentional and requires a certain level of commitment to try to understand oneself in the service of caring for other people. So it's purposeful attentiveness to mental processes during everyday work with the goal of practicing with clarity and compassion. And the during everyday work is important, because it's a moment-to-moment thing that you're engaged in as part of the practice. It's part of the fabric of your practice of medicine. It's not, mindfulness is not something that you do when you get home or in a group outside of your practice. It's something that, an activity that you're engaged in. And we all do this. I mean, all of these qualities are familiar to us. They're naturally occurring human capacities that if we bring it to our attention and the attention of our learners, give it a name and provide some external validation, we're all capable of doing, and I think of generalizing to more situations than just the ones that we do spontaneously. So there's nothing magical about this. You know, when it's really more descriptive. So mindful practice consists of, in a simplified version, the ability to be attentive, to be observant and non-reactive, the ability to be curious without judging, without assigning cause or blame or good or bad. It's the ability to adopt a beginner's mind, that is, to see a situation from more than one perspective. One of the problems with expertise is that we begin to only assume one stance, one perspective. So if we're a cardiologist, we see everything as pertaining to the heart or not of interest. But if we then ask that cardiologist, well, let's just imagine that you were a gastroenterologist. How might you see this situation? Okay. You know, it's tricky. It's hard to do. But for a third year medical student, that's pretty easy because they're not an expert. They're still pretty undifferentiated. They may not be as competent in any one of the areas, but that mental suppleness may still be there. So how do we pay attention to things? And this is, again, some lessons from neurocognitive research. There are three kinds of attention, and one is vigilance for anticipated events. The second kind of attention is what's called orienting, which is when you have multiple sensory input of selecting certain information as relevant and ignoring other information. So an example, I had a patient who had a history of rotator cuff injury and had difficulty raising his arm and came in complaining of shoulder pain. And two different clinicians examined him. And on the second visit, he also said that, you know, he was having night sweats and fevers. And that was even noted in the chart on the second time. Patient also complains of night sweats and fevers, but no follow-up, no physical exam, nothing having any assessment and plan. Both of the clinicians missed the absolutely enormous axillary node that was the first marker of a mantle cell lymphoma. They were looking at him. His shirt was off. But because they were so focused on this shoulder, they just didn't see it. And that's a problem of orienting attention. They were looking for swelling around the AC joint, or they were looking for range of motion at the glenohumeral joint. And then finally, there's executive attention, which is the management of unanticipated events. And interesting that that same little part of the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex, that little crossroads that helps to control the filtering function that we all have, those descending pathways, is the center for executive attention. So the capacity to be aware of the unanticipated and not block it out is also closely connected to our ability to take in new sensory input. So our first three physicians basically shut down their medial prefrontal cortex. Our fourth one opened us up a little bit. Now, this may sound all kind of magical and abstract, but people can actually learn to do this. That is, if you ask people while they're in the scanner to attend to things in different ways, the medial prefrontal cortex will light up. So you can actually teach people relatively, it's possible to teach people to do this. I don't know how easy it is or how hard it is, because all these studies are done in very tightly controlled experimental situations. But in situations where they do vary cognitive load. But applying that knowledge to when you're sitting there with a patient, or you're in the ICU, you and your patient's going into shock, or you're in the operating room and someone tells you your patient has a blue kidney. We don't know about that. This is just provocative at this point. So how do we know when we're out of the box? Now, wouldn't you think this would be relatively important to know, and maybe something that might be a fundamental component of competence? That is, knowing the limits of your competence in the moment, knowing when you need help or knowing when you need more information, when you need to open those gates so more perceptual information can come in. So we have several choices. One is to, when we're out of the box, seeking help. Another option is, how do we expand this optimal work zone? So part of the training, I think, of surgeons and obstetricians and intensivists is learning to work in situations of very high anxiety and very low hedonic tone. Okay? So in situations where you're scared out of your mind, and it's not really very pleasant, and you want to make the right decision. So how do you lower your reactivity so that you can, you in that same situation that 5 years ago would have led to a premature decision, would have led to one of those first three clinicians? How do you learn to do that? I think that we do learn that in some way, but it's largely been tacit. Ellen Langer, who's written about mindful education, points to three ways of cultivating habits of mind that would allow for greater openness. One is learning to see information as novel. Even if you've seen this patient 42 times for the same complaint, to find something new, something interesting. To see facts as conditional. So you can say this is someone with reflux disease, or you could say this might be someone with reflux disease, and putting the subjunctive consciously into your differential diagnosis, into your thinking. So I mentioned yesterday George Engel had a habit of whenever someone presented a patient with a diagnosis, he would say not. Okay, so. So he would say to himself, you know, he's being presented a patient with, you know, congestive heart failure. He would then think, okay, if this were anything but congestive heart failure, how could I put the situation together? It's a mental heuristic that he used. Seeing situations from multiple perspectives simultaneously, something that I use is, if I'm in a diagnostic quandary, I would say, well, what would Dr. Engel have done in this situation? Or what would someone else... So I'm trying to put myself in someone else's shoes. Or if it seems like a cardiac problem, what would Dr. So-and-so say about this? What might they... So in a way, to take myself out of my own perspectives. Two other things. Temporarily suspending categorization and judgment. So to say... Again, that's kind of what George Engel is doing, just saying, it's not this, let's gather more data. And then developing habits of self-questioning, such as what feelings are affecting my ability to observe? What am I assuming that might not be true? How are prior experiences and expectations coloring my view of the situation? Did I use fuzzy logic or a cognitive alibi to justify my conclusion? A cognitive alibi is kind of a faulty reasoning kind of thing. What would a trusted peer say about the way I manage the situation? Am I really done, or am I engaging in premature closure? Now, these are really simple questions, and these are things that I actually ask students and residents on rounds. Okay, so they'll present a case, I'll ask them about the differential diagnosis, whatever it is, and say, okay, how do you know you're not engaging in premature closure? You know, how do you know, is there something you're assuming here that might not be true? They're very ordinary questions. I don't call them mindfulness questions. I don't call them reflective questions. But they're questions that tend to open up. And as Nagarjuna said, questions that tend not towards edification. Okay, they tend not to create bodies of knowledge. They tend to, in a way, dissolve your preconceived notions of a situation. Now, this is a little bit discomforting to do this because people like to be sure of themselves, so you need to do this in somewhat of a facilitating environment. So what qualities of mindful practitioners are we trying to foster? The first is motivation. The second is this perceptual ability versus, you know, tone deafness, or as we saw in that video of the basketball players. Some degree of openness, diminished reactivity, that is not feeling you need to solve the problem, and this thing that I like to call mental stability. And I don't know how many of you have canoed or kayaked or bought a canoe or a kayak. So when you buy one of these boats, they talk about what they call primary stability and secondary stability. Now, primary stability is how tippy the boat feels. And secondary stability is how easy it is to capsize. Now, in general, when you want to buy a boat that's very maneuverable and supple, you want to get a boat that feels a little tippy, that has a little bit of primary instability, but has a lot of secondary stability. So you can turn it, you can maneuver it, but you know that it's not going to capsize. And so I'll use this metaphor with students and residents, saying, okay, you can be a little bit wrong here. It's okay as you're thinking through the situation, because we're not going to decide what to do right this moment. Okay, you can feel a little bit tippy. You can be a little unsure of yourself. And in fact, tell me what details of this case make you feel a bit uncertain. And in fact, I'm interested in two things. One is, of course, it's important to come up with the right diagnosis. But even more important at your level of training is to understand what blind alleys you tend to find yourself in. So tell me about those blind alleys and how you got yourself there. So in the 1999 article, I left in a sentence that I still am not quite sure if it's true or not. And you know, it's funny, once you put something in writing and lots of people read it, then it comes back to it. And I said that mindful practice cannot be taught, but that it can be evoked and facilitated, nurtured through example. And I'm not sure if it's true or not. I really don't know. But at least now I'm kind of trying to see what the boundaries are. For example, learning to be attentive in other circumstances, that is, learning to do meditation or learning to pay attention to other, to do yoga or to other things that are awareness-enhancing activities, do they translate into medical practice or not? I don't know. Informal practice, I noticed that spontaneously, without thinking about it, before I go in to see a patient and I touch the doorknob, I just have this habit of taking a breath and then just kind of giving myself a second, and then I walk in the room. I hesitate and you know, it would be hardly noticeable to anyone. But I realize what I do during that moment is I somehow set aside what happened before so I can be fresh coming in to see the patient. Now, can you teach people to do that? Is that a really helpful thing to do? Well, it seems simple enough. Stop, breathe, be for a second, and then go in. Does reflection enhanced mindfulness, that is, discussing a case and your thoughts and feelings about it ex post facto, after the fact, does that help you be more mindful? Does the structure of health systems, now there's been a lot of work in aviation as well as in the structure of intensive care units and operating rooms, that seem to indicate that collective vigilance is contagious. That is, if other people in your environment are vigilant in a certain way, that will create an environment that makes it easier for you to be vigilant. So is this a systems problem? The programs that we've designed in Rochester really have two goals. One is to improve the quality of care and caring. Quality of care and caring for the patient. And the second has to do with the quality of care and caring for oneself as a healthcare practitioner. And I think that, I like to show this as part of the presentation about stress, but I think that they're related. And some of the work that Schoenfeld has done on burnout in clinicians may be relevant here. that is then when clinicians are more burned out, they at least report that they're less safe and they're also less caring towards patients. They report less empathy. So we wanted to look at whether training in mindfulness would actually affect levels of burnout, empathy, a psychosocial orientation towards care, that is, interest in the patient as a person, as well as the physician's own emotional state, their own well-being. So we, and I won't belabor this, but burnout is a pretty important problem in medical students and residents, and as well as practicing physicians. So the program that we put together for practicing physicians involved 8 weekly sessions of 2.5 hours, a full-day silent retreat, and then 2.5-hour sessions every month for the subsequent 10 months. This is a major commitment. But we wanted to see if a dose of mindfulness-enhancing activities might actually change their clinical practice as well as their own sense of well-being. The program consisted of 4 components. There was a small didactic component. We also did guided meditation, paying attention to the breath, to bodily sensations, to thoughts and feelings, and really emphasizing not judging those thoughts and feelings, but just being aware, just enhancing awareness. That was sitting meditation, walking meditation, yoga kind of exercises, a variety of things. And then we did 2, we used narrative exercises, that is having people write stories and share them in pairs, as well as something called appreciative inquiry, which is again another paired storytelling exercise about important events in their medical practice, events having to do with suffering, healing, attraction to patients, difficult patients, saying goodbye, medical errors, conflict, time management, all the kind of difficult things that the clinicians find challenging. The importance of those exercises was not to really come up with solutions to how they would deal with these stressors, but rather a chance to tell the story and observe their own reactivity while they were doing the telling, and being a listener and being aware of their own reactivity as a listener, their need to fix the situation, their need to tune out, their need to compare the other person's situation with something that they had experienced. Well, let me tell you my story. So it was really an exercise in interpersonal mindfulness more than problem solving. And this was very, very explicit. There was some discussion, but the sessions were otherwise quite highly structured. We had people fill out surveys before and after the program, and I can interpret the various scales, but survey 4 was at the end of a year, and survey 5 was 3 months after the program had ended. And you always, with any intervention, expect some attenuation of the effect after it's done. So this is the physician belief scale, which basically has to do with whether they're interested in the psychosocial aspects of their patients' lives, whether they're curious or interested in their patients' psychological state as well as their family and social networks. These are 3 components of an empathy scale. There are 3. This is a commonly used scale in medical education. One's called perspective taking, compassionate care, and also the ability to stand in patient's shoes. And you can see that, the blue line is kind of the sum total. The thing that interested me was the sum total actually even continued to rise after the program was over. These are the burnout scales. There are 3 components of this as well. One is emotional exhaustion. The second is depersonalization. Both of those went down and continued going down. And the third one is reverse-coded and has to do with a sense of personal accomplishment. And that, so you can notice that those, even at the end of the program, tended to either be stable or continue improving. There are actually measures of mindfulness, and as expected, and we also found that mindfulness mediated these effects, so that that seemed to be the active ingredient. The profile of mood states, that's just, you can see on the bottom, tension, depression, anxiety, vigor, confusion, and then there was a total scale that was the brown line. Again, those tended to improve and revert somewhat, but didn't really seem to be heading back to where they started. And then finally, these are actually measures of personality. Now, personality is not supposed to change at age 40 or 50, but we found significant reductions in neuroticism, which is the tendency to see the dark side of things. These all have funny definitions. I wouldn't use these terms necessarily. But we didn't expect this at all. We actually tended to use this as a covariate. But we then saw these changes. So, and just thinking about wellness practices of physicians, we recorded, like Eric Weiner did a study also, but we more or less confirmed the findings that the active ingredient of all this had to do with the last of these, which is developing a different attitude towards life. It wasn't particularly anything that they said that they did, but that in fact it changed the way that they view themselves. So finally, there are some questions that we're left with. First of all, does mindfulness contribute to variability of quality of technical and interpersonal care? So our next steps are going to actually look at the care delivered and see if these interventions can make the difference that physicians report in more objective measures. Can mindfulness reduce errors and improve quality of care? And then finally, a more philosophical question, is this an individual quality, a team quality, or an organizational quality? And to what degree do these factors seem to contribute to mindful practice? So with that, I'm going to close and we have some time for questions.
We purposely asked Ron to keep his remarks to the zero of the time, so there is time for questions, comments, and dialogue. So we'd like to open it up with pleasure.
Linda. Thank you very much. That was very interesting. I'm wondering if one of those questions at the end says that the quality of
I think it's an important question, and we in naturally occurring clinical encounters, we know that those that in which there's more empathy expressed and that those that adopt a more patient-centered approach are slightly longer. However, in training, in intervention studies, where you train physicians to be more patient-centered, it in fact tends to shorten consultations. So there's a difference between the naturalistic observation and what is potentially possible. We did another study, one of our standardized patient studies, where we looked at physician self-disclosure, as when doctors talk about themselves. First of all, almost all the self-disclosures had nothing to do with anything that was concerning the patient. And many of them took quite a bit of time. And in retrospect, the physicians weren't even really aware that they were wasting time. So that's just one example. Or if you're taking a more mindful approach to a diagnostic interview, maybe you won't ask the same question three or four times, which, you won't. I mean, the first three video examples of physicians, essentially they wasted time. Okay, so my hope would be that by being more aware and present, that at least the diagnostic parts of the medical encounter might be more efficient. Now, I'm not saying that we should then shorten medical encounters. I would say, well, maybe we use the residual time for relationship building, because that's really what patients want. Yeah. I think that's a learned skill of an expert clinician. Carolyn Moulton, a hepatobiliary surgeon in Toronto, has published a couple of papers describing when surgeons slow down. So she'll be observing an operation, and then there'll be the moment the surgeon asks the tech to turn the radio, to turn the radio off, turn the music off. Okay. And clearly is more deliberative and is moving slower. So how do they know when to transition into that mode, or how do we know? And I've had exactly that same experience in code situations. I often feel that time slows down unbelievably, so that everything seems like it's going in slow motion, which is exactly the opposite of what you might expect. But it also gives me more space to act, and I think that's kind of a good thing. Yeah. Now, I think we've trained ourselves to do that in those really extreme situations. So now I worry not about the extreme situations, because I know I'll do okay in those. I worry about the situations that are kind of somewhere in the middle. And the thing that I really worry about at this phase of career is boredom. I'll say, I've seen this before, I know this patient so well, you know, here we go again. So for me, I think a greater risk is boredom. You know, it's I know their work, and I know they use that as a principle. The way that I can put it together is to be able to face failure with a lowered level of reactivity. That is, you can examine system failures more dispassionately and not feel that you either have to run away from them or kind of close the door. That failure should provoke curiosity. But I think one area in which I might disagree might have to do with method, because we found that this appreciative inquiry approach is actually incredibly powerful, because that explicitly asks people to identify successes in the face of difficult situations. And what inevitably happens is that people find that extraordinarily difficult to do, because they're so focused on what went wrong. But when they're able to do it, they report then that they have an enhanced capacity or an enhanced level of self-confidence and self-efficacy. The problem with these kinds of theories is they're very, very hard to prove or disprove, and I think that probably the answer is both and. That paying attention to failure and being and having lower reactivity is probably useful, and also focusing on what your strengths and successes are is also useful. So I, even though they might sound inherently contradictory, I think they may actually work in different ways. Now, what might be interesting is to have people actually do those activities mentally and put them in an fMRI scanner and see, in fact, you know, if their brain's working differently. So I'm sure some experimental psychologist has thought of that already. But even if we saw differences, would that mean that one is right and one is wrong? I don't know. There was not in our cohort of 70. Years in practice disappeared from the regression equation. I gave a presentation to a group of residents a number of years ago, and someone said something like, "You know, they ask us to work 80 hours a week to fill out all this paperwork, to do all the unpleasant tasks the attendants want to do, and now you want me to be mindful?" you're right. I mean, at what developmental level do we introduce some of this, and also what kind of inoculation do we do before students experience the cognitive overload? So do we teach mindfulness techniques when they're still in their first year of medical school that they then hopefully would bring into a different context, and does that help? Do we try to embed it into a third-year medical school curriculum? Do we wait till students are residents? Do we wait till they're practicing physicians? Do we try to do this for everybody? Do we just try to wait for people to seek us out? I don't know. And it's an unanswered question. And, is also the possibility of introducing the idea of mindfulness actually going to increase their cognitive load? We haven't found that necessarily to be true, at least, observing informally. My gut feeling is to gently introduce the idea that so that students recognize when they're being mindful and celebrate it and say this is a sign of achievement and something that is a marker of expertise and also something that they can... we can say that other people might notice to some degree. And at that level, I don't see how it can be harmful. Just saying that, here it is, not to create this expectation that they're going to walk on water, but just to say, okay, here's this thing that's really important. And just pay attention, see if it happens, and see under what conditions it happens. And maybe you can bring that attitude of mind, that habit of mind, into other situations. Yeah. I'm sorry for being over.
The question of the timing of when brings to mind for me that there's a whole question. There was a recent large conference in Washington looking at mindfulness in elementary schools, introducing it to the educational system for all U.S. children, for example, try that out in kindergarten, for example. Mm-hmm. Looking at modern practice in ways that are focused for children and learning. So, what's the question? The question is how much, like last. The question I'm asking is how much are these skills in mindfulness, mindful practice, specific to medicine, and how much are they life skills that are valuable and goal-oriented or whatever, the kind of thing you want for anyone to become a more comfortable human being or whatever, as opposed to a medical thing, medicine. Why not for a health learning question for all kids or for everybody, in some respect?
You've answered your own question, I think. And my kids also went to a school where they learned mindfulness activities and self-assessment and peer assessment starting with kindergarten. And I think actually it's made a, it's hard to know with education what's made the difference. But they do have a capacity for self-reflection, and they do value it, even though, in the teenage years, it's sometimes hard to find. We were really fortunate because we got three grants at the same time. We got a grant for the physician program and then two grants for the student and resident program. So we really had the opportunity while we were doing this program for the primary care physicians to also do a program for all third-year medical students as well as all 350 residents in the 9 largest residency programs in the institution, all simultaneously, as well as training facilitators from each of those 9 departments. So and the facilitators were generally faculty with whom the students had significant contact. So we knew that in each of those rotations and residency settings that there would be available at least a couple of role models of people who, I don't know if they were any more mindful than anyone else, and I think that would be a false claim, but at least that they valued this process of becoming mindful and could be somewhat intentional about it. And so we, in trying to implement the program, I just simply wasn't going to do it if it was a medical student-only initiative. I thought that would be doomed to failure. I've tried other programs in medical education trying to change the culture of medical school, and it's pretty recalcitrant. So I think that you need to start with very modest goals. What we notice in our institution is that people use the word mindful a fair bit as a positive attribute. And sometimes they kind of make fun of me. But I'm old enough to take it at this point.
Take one last question from Anna. It was along the students' lines. This is not a basic human skill.
I think this is a basic life skill of being able to listen to yourself and listen to others. And in my view, this is one of the fundamental ingredients behind world peace. If people had this capacity for lowered reactivity, perhaps, Israelis and Palestinians might actually be able to talk to each other. One can only hope.